Good morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Policy Division to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Good morning, everyone. Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Frederick.
Present.
Frankie.
Frankie, present.
Backer. Baker. Becker Finn.
Present.
Hansen.
Present.
Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Lippert.
Present.
Moeller. Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. It's good to hear we've got quorum. First item on the agenda we have this morning is approval of the minutes. Representative Lippert, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I've reviewed the minutes, Mr. Chair, and I move the approval of the minutes.
Are there any corrections or questions on the minutes? Hearing none, seeing no hands up, Representative Lippert moves approval of the minutes for February 2nd, 2022. Please unmute for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, today we'll be listening to a number of presenters from the substance use disorder community on the needs of providers and patients to ensure successful long-term recovery. The content of these presentations ties to legislation that Representative Vice Chair Frederick will be authoring this session, a legislation that I know that he's been working on with a number of people, including working closely with Representative Frankie. We do not have the official bill at this point in time. We have the revised draft, and this has been posted on the committee website as we await its introduction. The draft is coded 22-05034, and there's also currently an A7 author's amendment drafted. We will not be taking any official action on this legislation today, and we will revisit this bill at a future hearing once it's been introduced. So please make sure to make note of any questions you may have for our testifiers. Vice Chair Frederick, I believe that you're going to be starting the presentation, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick logistical note. I did get notice from the revisor yesterday that the jackets were delivered, so I plan on getting those introduced ASAP. So I want to start off by saying thank you to the chair for the support on this bill. I also want to specifically thank Ms. Delwu for the work and that she has put in on this. Her passion is very clear. When we talk about SUD treatment, one of the things that's quite often part of the conversation is relapse. And we're not talking somebody goes through treatment and it's relapse once and then they're good. It's quite often a story of relapse multiple times. Part of the reason for that is that once they complete treatment, unfortunately, there's some expectation that they're just going to be successful. But if they don't have a place to go, where do people end up going? Back into the same communities and possibly the same situation where they were getting into some of these troubles to begin with.
Can you guys take care? Thank you so much.
So part of the bill, and one of my favorite parts, is a housing support. And what it does is creates a safe place to go for someone who's successfully completed treatment. And in several of the conversations that I've had on that specifically, one of the things I kept thinking about is how many parallels there are between people who successfully complete treatment, go back into the community, and then have struggles again. And the parallel between that and the criminal justice system of how people have served a jail time, get out, and somehow we're expecting them just to be successful and be fine in the community. And they run into the same issues with not enough supports post-incarceration. So in the conversations with Deed actually requested an amendment. So in the amendment language, there's housing support, not just for those that successfully complete treatment, but also those exiting the criminal justice system, which I thought was fabulous. I think the more that we can do up front to support people, the better long-term we as a state are going to be. But I'll let other people talk about the house or any more of the housing stuff. There's other things in the bill regarding services that are provided. Right now, if someone's in college doing an internship and at the end of that internship, there might be a delay before they get licensed from the state. You know, it could be up to 3 months. And we want people to have, you know, we're having workforce shortage issues everywhere to provide it that kind of gap between the end of their internship, end of schooling, by the time they get their licensure, to be able to keep providing services in the interim there. There's a lot of other things going on. I could keep talking for a while about it, but really, I think we probably should just hear from the people that know it way better than I do. So, Mr. Chair, I, at your discretion, would turn it over to the testifiers.
Okay, thank you, Representative Frederick. The first person I have on the agenda here to speak to us will be Ms. Amy Delwu. If you'd like to introduce yourself and start your presentation, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amy Delwo, and I am the Vice President of Public Policy at NUWAY. However, today I'm here as the President-elect of MARCH. The MARCH membership and those who are here to speak today are grateful for the precious committee time that you've given, Mr. Chair, to hear this topic. We've dubbed the bill Pathways to Recovery. And in fact, in your handout, you have a packet that demonstrates that that pathway is not always a linear one. Now, a person who knew this really well and a dear friend of ours was Mr. Mark Jonagan. He founded the Twin Cities Recovery Project several years ago after finding recovery himself. And he was a board member and a cherished voice on the MARCH board. And he was actually the true expression of what it means to live recovery. Sadly, Mark lost his life in a fatal car accident in December. And we'd like to honor him today with our testimony. We'd also like to thank Representative Luke Frederick for his time and attention to this subject matter and his willingness to author the bill, and also the co-authors that will be signing soon. Before we start the hearing here, I wanted to highlight a couple headlines just to steep us in what the current reality is. And I'll read a few of them. More than 1 million Americans died from an overdose during the opioid epidemic. And for a little context, the COVID pandemic has not yet reached that grim milestone. Another headline is that alcohol consumption during the COVID-19 pandemic is projected to cause more liver disease and deaths. And we don't often discuss all the ways that substance use disorder impacts a person's health and their lives. And this is an example of one of them. And that alcohol is still one of the number one substances of use and abuse in the state of Minnesota. And finally, there's a new addiction stigma index that calls to action for us and every advocate everywhere. There was a survey done by Shatterproof of the public, and 75% of those believed that SUD, or substance use disorder, was not a chronic disease. So with all of these things in the headlines, I just wanted to show this chart that indicates that steadily over time, we've served more and more people as the population has grown, but we've also known that during this time where there is more and more need for substance use disorder. Between 2019 and 2020, we actually saw 7,500 people less in Minnesota get access to treatment, and we need to be focusing on this topic. So with that, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do is stop sharing my screen and hand this over to Dr. John Kelly, who will begin his presentation about substance use disorder and as a chronic disease. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Delwu. Dr. John Kelly, if you'd like to introduce yourself and then start your testimony.
Thank you. Hope you can hear me. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to be here with you all. Hope you can see my screen okay.
We sure can, sir.
Very good, thank you. I'm going to talk this morning for the next 15 minutes about addiction as a chronic illness, what we've learned, why we've come to this conclusion that it needs to be treated as a chronic illness. We've actually talked about treating it as a chronic illness for many decades, but we are finally starting to talk about addiction as a chronic illness. Now, last year marked the 50-year milestone since the declaration of the war on drugs. We've come a long way in the last 50 years We've seen the birth of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. We've seen the birth of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, SAMHSA, CSAT. All of these national federal agencies have come about in the last 50 years. We normally associate, of course, the war on drugs as being the harsh punitive rhetoric associated and the harsh criminal sentencing that went along with it. But also there's been a great move in public health understanding, clinical understanding of the nature of these disorders and how best to address these endemic problems, which are not going away. They're in fact getting worse. These are just some of the things that we've learned in terms of our understanding of addiction. We understand its genetic influence. We understand it's a complex disorder that's not just genetic, but also is environmentally caused through the interaction of genetics over time in the developing genome. We also understand of the impact of substances on the brain, the neuroplasticity, and understanding what factors, what aspects of the brain and neurocircuitry and structure are changed. We also have understood more about the epidemiology in the last 50 years. We've learned more in the last 50 years than all of time before it in terms of risk factors for onset of substance use disorder, both pathways into it, through it, and out the other side. We've learned a lot about the clinical course. We've developed many different types of pharmacological, psychosocial treatments, which have had a big impact in terms of affecting the public health status of these disorders. Neuroplasticity is a fairly new understanding in terms of truly understanding the impact of chronic exposure to alcohol or other drugs in the brain. We can see this now very clearly with neuroimaging in terms of its functional impact as well as its structural impact. Certain drugs, methamphetamine, alcohol, will actually change the brain through killing the brain cells. We also know that on the other side, in recovery, the brain recovers. Once you remove the toxins from the brain, Mother Nature can do her job. You can see here that after about 14 months here, the brain of somebody with methamphetamine use disorder, for example, is beginning to show normalcy in terms of functional status, but it can take quite a while. Some of the important things we've learned in the last 30 years, which is relatively new, is the status of individuals as they attempt to get into recovery. We know now that neuroendocrine system, the neurocentral nervous system, is radically impaired. It's radically maladapted, maladjusted. People have increased sensitivity to stress, and coupled with that, a down-regulated ability to capacity to experience normal levels of reward. It can take many months, even years, for this to re-regulate and recalibrate as people are starting to change. Now, we commonly think about this as post-acute withdrawal phenomena or protracted withdrawal. We've done a very good job in the last 50 years of detoxification and stabilization. We're less clear on exactly how best to, less clear on how exactly to treat and address these longer-term protracted problems, which result from the neurological impact of exposure to these substances. Let me give you a picture of kind of why we think about it as a chronic illness that we've learned from clinical studies, community studies, as well as epidemiological and cross-sectional studies. We now know that it takes quite a while for people to establish a foothold in recovery after they begin an attempt to change. This in the middle here, you can see it takes about 8 years after people start to seek help and about 4 to 5 treatment episodes before people achieve that first year of full sustained remission. What's also noteworthy, if you look on the right-hand side here, is that even after people achieve that first year of full sustained remission, which in and of itself, of course, is a massive achievement, it takes 4 to 5 years of continuous remission before the risk of meeting criteria for an alcohol or other drug use disorder in the following year drops below 15%. Why 15%? Because that's the annual risk in the general population of meeting criteria for an alcohol or other drug use disorder in any given year. So to be no more likely than anybody else in the general population of meeting criteria for substance use disorder in the following year, if you've already had it, takes 4 to 5 years of continuous remission. So risk for reinstatement of the disorder remains elevated, not for 90 days, not for 6 months, but for 5 years relative to the general population. It is that recognition of this elevated risk and this bumpy ride into remission, which has necessitated the reorientation, restructuring of services around treating addiction as a chronic illness. The question is, can we speed this up even more? Can we help more people into recovery sooner and also into stable remission sooner? And I think the answer is definitely yes, by reorienting, restructuring services, providing not just acute care stabilization and clinical care, but very importantly, the kinds of things that Representative Frederick was also mentioning this morning, which is things like housing, jobs, training, access to what we call recovery capital that can instill hope and help people achieve, get some traction in their life. I use this metaphor of a burning building to describe what we've done in the last 50 years. We've recognized that there is an emergency situation. The building is on fire. We need to put the fire out. Like I said, we've done that extremely well. We put the fire out. We can provide detoxification, stabilization, life-saving, very critically important. We have to put the fire out. Thereafter, we've tended to drop the ball in terms of how do we help people rebuild the building, provide the building materials, often called recovery capital, the scaffolding needed for people to be able to get back on track, and also, very importantly, the building permit that people need to be able to start building their life again. Oftentimes, due to prior convictions, people are unable to get a bank account, to get a loan, to get housing, to get the exact things that they need in order to get a foothold in recovery. So those building permits are often denied people because of prior criminal convictions. And this is something that we need to address. So one of the things that we have learned in our learning, and which is feeding in now at the federal level, to provision of recovery support services, which include housing, jobs, social networks, recovery community centers, all the kinds of things that people need beyond the acute care stabilization, are important ingredients of stable remission and recovery. So we need to do both. We need to attend both to the clinical stabilization and the professionally directed care, which is life-saving and can be life-saving for so many. But beyond that, to provide ongoing recovery management and recovery monitoring in the communities in which people live and provide services that people need, housing, jobs, training, education, and social connection to be able to sustain recovery. And these are the active ingredients of recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Green. Dr. Green's not going to be able to stay with us through the end of the meeting. So at this point, if anybody has any questions, if you could please raise your hand for Dr. Green and I can call on you.
Dr. Kelly, Mr.
Chair. Excuse me, Dr. Kelly. I apologize. Mr. Green is our next person that's coming up. Dr. Kelly, are there any questions? Representative Keith Franke, go ahead, sir.
I just want to thank Dr. Kelly for the great presentation. You know, one of the things during my recovery that I've always talked about is how, and this kind of gives an explanation to it, how my brain and just the ability to feel and things like that, it took a couple of years to pull myself out. So kind of having a educational way to explain this to others, I think is very helpful. So I appreciate Dr. Kelly's presentation and the ability to be able to put that to paper and for people who have not lived recovery, allow them the ability to possibly understand. So thank you, Dr. Kelly.
Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Kelly? Not seeing anything. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for the presentation today. It was very informative. I've learned quite a bit on it.
And, my pleasure.
You're welcome, sir. And next we'll move on to Mr. Peter Green.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Peter Green. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to speak before the committee this day. My purpose for being here today is to share with this committee my experience as a long-term recovering person and an employee in the field of substance abuse for over 30 years. The five most important factors to my early success in recovery and still today are as follows: housing, transportation, employment, family and set a support network. Fortunately for me, I lived in a metro area that provided a great transit system, a loving, supportive family that allowed stable housing. My employer had produced a built-in program that paid 40% of my wages, and the employer paid 60% of my wages. Like myself, the clients that I've had the privilege of working with have many roadblocks with criminal justice involvement and other vicious cycles. They lack an ongoing chance for recovery. If you do not have access to sober living or sober living environment while in recovery, it can be a trigger that caused some people to return to use. Early in recovery, I had access to a good transit system that allowed me to work my program and get to and from support groups. Today, I have my own car to do so. Meetings and a support network are essential to my sobriety early in recovery and still today. If people are to work a recovery program, they need to be equipped to do so. Transportation and childcare access could eliminate barriers from people to a recovery lifestyle. The recovery journey for me took many years before I was comfortable. The first 3 years were about abstaining from the use of drugs and alcohol, but mostly about discovering who I am. The next couple of years were about truly discarding the things that wasn't serving me anymore. Only about 5 years did I really feel I was in a place of recovery. Many of the clients I have seen over the past years have struggled to get to that point or that place. Due to an inability to have poor support with finances, vocational, emotional, and social skills, with this bill, it would allow unfortunate people a real chance to move on from treatment or discovery and closer to the bridge of recovery. Mr. Chair and members, this concludes my portion of the presentation. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Green, for your testimony and for sharing your story with us and your experiences. Are there any questions for Mr. Green? Not seeing any, we will move on to our next testifier. Our next testifier is Mr. Anderson St. George. Mr. Anderson St. George, if you'd like to introduce yourself, tell us who you're with and start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. My name is Anderson St. George's. I am a licensed alcohol and drug counselor and certified prevention professional, working as executive director both at Compassion Health Treatment Services and Daystar Recovery Center in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. I completed my master's in addiction studies at Hazelden and Betty Ford Graduate School of Addiction Studies, and I have been practicing in the state of Minnesota for 5 years. I am a March board member and co-chair of the World Health and Disparities Committee, which mission is to identify and document disparities in services in rural areas, determine barriers that cause them, and recommend policies to overcome them. Today, I will be speaking about how the day-to-day burden of managing caseload and duplicative documentation decrease therapeutic relationship with clients, increase higher risk of burnout, and compassion fatigue. Furthermore, I will be advocating for holiday hour to be permitted in residential sites in order to encourage personal care and family time, both for counselors and clients. The first topic I'd like to talk about is eliminating duplicative documentation and extending timeline will increase client staff interaction and therapeutic relationship. During my years of working as a counselor, I found it fascinating how direct care staff or in charge of clients have more clinical documentations or clinical information about clients in regards to the amount of information that the client disclosed to the direct care staff. Upon asking clients why they feel comfortable sharing privileged clinical information with direct care staff, some of my clients reported that they feel that they can be real with the direct care staff They feel that they can interact with the direct care staff and have genuine one-on-one conversation without feeling like someone is documenting their behaviors. From my clinical observation, I believe the clients are right. Working in a rural Minnesota where the LADC shortage and workforce crisis have been exacerbated by COVID-19, at times, as a program director, I found myself a screening client, completing intakes, providing orientation, leading group counseling, doing crisis management, and transporting clients. I'm doing a lot of work within the 12 core function of a counselor and also having to manage crisis at times where I have to call the police. I have to do, helping the clients managing their emotions. And sometimes crisis happen around 3 o'clock. Sometimes it happened morning. Sometimes it happened last minute. So in order to manage those crises and making the sure that the clients are safe, my first request is in lieu of having to document some of the significant event right away, having a 24-hour extension will allow the counselor to be able to take care of the crisis with the clients. If they have to go home, take care of their family, or practice self-care, de-escalate, the following day they can come back and document about the significant event without running the risk of being non-compliant with the 245G compliance. Another thing I would like to talk about is also eliminating duplicated documentation. Upon intake, a counselor have to do comprehensive assessment summary. And within 3 days, the same counselor for the same client will do comprehensive assessment summary review, which is the same document they collected during the comprehensive assessment. After each group counseling, we have to document what we shared in group with the clients. After that, we'd have to do individual session. However, at the end of the week, we need to collect all the information and show how the clients benefited from all those groups, which take a lot of time from the counselor to have one-on-one with the clients, but to spend more time documenting those events in order to be compliant with the 245G. As a result, we are asking that we have a 28-day treatment plan review in lieu of a weekly treatment plan review so that the counselors can spend more time with their clients. I have also to note as well, for the mental health providers, they have up to 180 days for a treatment plan review in comparison to the counselors, drug and alcohol counselors, that have a weekly treatment plan review. And further testimony is, I developed the theory, which is the recovery in action, where we teach the clients the positive coping skills, but at the same time, they do practice them in while they're receiving treatment. I've had the privilege of taking clients fishing. I've taken clients play frisbee golf. I've taken clients for nature walks. We take the clients to exercise, and I exercise and role model positive behaviors. I can tell you that during those moments where I spend one-on-one with the clients and genuinely spending time without interference of documentation, I learn more about the clients. They let the guard down and they can share more information. So decreasing the pressure of documentation to be in compliance with every little details and spending more time with the client will be highly beneficial to increase clients' compliance, graduation rate, and also lessen burnout for the counselors who has to operate under a lot of pressure, because some counselor can have up to 10 clients, 15 clients on their caseload, depends on where they are working. The last portion I would like to advocate for is permitting holiday hour relief for personal care for the counselors. At this time, the counselors still have to work federal holiday if it falls during the week, because they need to accumulate treatment hours. High intensity for a client need to have 30 hours, medium intensity need to have 15 hours. And sometimes, if it is a holiday, it would be good for the counselor to be able to step back, practice self-care, spend some time with their family, and for the clients also to use the opportunity to practice the positive coping skills they learn in treatment. Some clients' holidays are a major trigger for them. And if they're in treatment, they learn the positive coping skills, giving them a chance to spend time with their family, giving them a chance to practice those positive coping skills, giving them a chance to enjoy themselves is a wonderful thing that can increase their chance in recovery. So those are the points that I'd like to make. And I'm very grateful you gave me the opportunity to share. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. St. George's, for your testimony. And thank you particularly for reminding us about how important it is for our providers to be able to practice self-care. That's something I know that sometimes gets missed in the process and is also very important, very critical for the providers to be able to continue to do the good work that they do out there. I do see that we do have a question. Representative Becker-Finn, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank our testifier. We don't often hear the voices of the folks who are providing the care. We tend to in this body talk a lot about nurses and teachers and other folks who care for others in our community, but we often forget the folks who provide these kinds of mental health care services. And I just really wanted to thank you for your testimony this morning and sort of make that point that we often forget to even ask providers what they think of bills that we're working on. And I think that's one good thing about this committee is that it's a space to do that. But overall in our legislative body, we, we'll talk to the families of people who have mental illness and, we'll hear from sort of the management level, but we rarely hear from the folks who are providing the actual direct care face-to-face, helping people at when, they're really at their worst. And I think that I also just want to note too that often these folks are the folks who get paid the least in this system, and that's tied to reimbursement rates and a lot of reasons, but it's a continuing struggle to get people to do something that's so incredibly difficult when we're not paying them at a rate that really values and respects the level of work that you do. So not a question. I just wanted to really thank you for sharing your perspective and thank the chair for bringing in some of these voices today. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. I'm not seeing any other hands up right now, so we'll move on to the next person for their testimony is Ms. Sadie Brookemeyer. I hope I didn't slaughter the name too badly. But Ms. Brookemeyer, if you'd like to introduce yourself, tell us who you're with and start your testimony, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Sadie Brockmeyer. I am the president at Recovering Hope Treatment Center, a residential substance use facility for women and children, and pregnant women. I am a licensed drug and alcohol counselor and mental health therapist here in the state of Minnesota. I also work as an adjunct professor at Anoka Ramsey Community College in the Drug and Alcohol Studies program. I'm here today to speak as I serve as a representative on the March Board for Region 3. Today, I'm talking about the Article 2 proposed changes in the March proposal. The areas covered in this article pertain to workforce shortages and unattainable ratios that impact our ability to provide the care that clients deserve and receive appropriate funding for those services. When I'm teaching my students about working in the field of behavioral health, I often speak about the differences between theory and practice. I feel this comparison describes the challenges we have between the theory or statute and the practice of counseling. The intentions with statutes are to provide safety and clarity for those we serve. However, these statutes often have immense barriers on the way that we are able to provide care. We are seeing the impact of that lack of access to care and harmful policies are having in our communities with a 52% increase in overdoses in 2020. And this statistic doesn't even begin to describe the continued impact of other substances like alcohol and methamphetamine, both of which are the most common substances of choice for those that are admitted to treatment services in the state of Minnesota, according to the DANES data. Later on, Ms. Silverness will be talking about the proposed language change as it relates to program hours. I'm going to focus on the impact of the interpretation of these statutes has on providers' ability to provide client-centered care. Each program is required to offer 30, 15, or 6 hours of programming for each client, depending on what level of care the client is in. Most programs end up providing 30 to 40 hours of programming per week for high-intensity clients. The reason programs have to offer more than what is required is because the state does not determine program hours based off of what is offered. They determine it based off the hours the clients attend. This creates so many barriers for clients is that they may have a client-centered reason to not attend program hours. For example, in our program, a woman that delivers a baby usually returns to the facility about 2 to 3 days after delivery. And in order for our facility to be reimbursed for these services that for that client, she would need to attend 30 hours of programming if on high intensity. If she's not able to make those hours, we are only able to bill for board and lodge services or for lower level of care, despite that client receiving more individual support from our daycare team, from our direct care staff, from our medical team, including more transportation to the local clinic for appropriate follow-up care for her and her child. There are other many reasons or client-centered reasons that a client may not make their program hours. For example, court, meetings with, or child, per, I lost my, with court, meeting with attorneys, child visitation that can only be scheduled during the child protection workers' working hours, which is usually the same as program hours, illness or challenges with mental health or behavioral concerns. The clients that are not making their hours are usually the clients that are the most acute and in need of the most support outside of group programming. This then becomes a decision for staff on whether to discharge or transfer that client for non-compliance or to not receive appropriate funding for the services that they are providing. Another barrier to providing care is the co-occurring ratios for facilities. Currently, one of the requirements to receive funding for co-occurring services is the amount of mental health staff you have in ratio to the amount of drug and alcohol counselors you have. It is not dependent on the amount of clients that you're serving. It also has restrictions on what type of providers can be included in that ratio as a mental health professional. The theory or statute behind the ratio is to ensure that there's enough mental health coverage for those in need. However, the practice, the way that it's calculated, has many barriers. It impacts facilities by not being able to hire additional drug and alcohol counselors to reduce caseload size, because if we hire more drug and alcohol counselors, then we have to balance that out by hiring more mental health staff. It impacts the amount of drug and alcohol students that can complete their practicum, because in order to make sure that you can make your co-occurring hours, you have to balance your interns out with fully licensed mental health staff. It also impacts the ability to take on pre-licensed supervisees because there's only amount of pre-licensed staff that can be included in that ratio. Do you members know how long it takes to be become licensed, fully licensed in the state of Minnesota? At least 2 years. In addition to that, it takes an additional 2 years to become a board certified supervisor. With the workforce shortage being how it is challenging to find fully licensed individuals and even more challenging to find fully licensed individuals that want to work in a residential setting for substance use. Anderson talked about paperwork, and that is one of the main reasons people decide to go into a different area. Many of the therapists working on licensing, working on licensures use substance use facilities to start their careers and gain experience. And then when they're fully licensed, move into administrative roles, private practice, or mental health primary employment. Currently, there is such a need for therapists and licensed staff that organizations are offering up to $15,000 in a hiring bonus. By eliminating that current language and allowing for organizations to dictate the amount and availability of staff that works for their program would allow for an immediate change and have a positive impact in the client services. The other area that I'm going to speak on is the workforce shortage, as in regards to the workforce shortage, is that it correlates with the proposed language to have a license that allows for individuals to practice once they complete their internship and prior to the board approving their license. Currently, in their, those in their internships complete their application, gather appropriate documents, and have them ready to mail into the board the day that their grades are posted. Despite most of these students being proactive in their submission, it can still take 30 to 90 days for the board to approve the application. This means that organizations have to make the decision to onboard somebody that doesn't currently have a license and pay them at the rate they would for somebody with a license to do busy work like data entry or a paraprofessional role, or to pay a drug and or to wait to hire them till they're fully licensed, which means usually the candidate will find a different program to employ them, maybe the mainly the larger programs that have the financial ability to do so. And this also interrupts the client care of clients, as clients have to transition from a different counselor until that pre-licensed staff receives their approval from the board. Mr. Chair and members, this concludes my portion of the presentation, and I thank you for your time and attention to this matter.
Thank you, Ms. Brockmeyer, for sharing your experiences and your observations of what's happening out in the field and the challenges in the workforce. Are there any questions for Ms. Brockmeyer? Not seeing any, we'll move on to our next testifier then. Ms. Pam Lanhart, if you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and start your testimony, please.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Pam Lanhart. I am the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Thrive Family Recovery Resources, which was founded 7 years ago specifically to assist families impacted by their loved ones suffering from substance use disorder. Of special note, in October of 2021, I was the recipient of the Faces and Voices Vernon Johnson Award for my work in family advocacy. Thank you for allowing me to speak before the committee today. My job all day, every day, is to help families respond to substance use disorder with compassion, kindness, and empathy using evidence-based best practices in an effort to reduce harm in their families. What we know is that for every person impacted by substance use, there are at least three people peripherally impacted. That equates to approximately 75 million people in our country suffering as a result of substance use in their families. Our organization was born out of my personal experience in dealing with our young son who started using substances at the age of 12 and entered treatment for the first time at the age of 15. Jake was a young man who loved the outdoors. When things were hard, we would go out to the mountain and climb together as a family. And we would all find connection and peace at the top of a 14er. His goal was to climb all 58 summits in Colorado. Jake was a hard worker and one of the kindest human beings I know. He lit up a room when he entered it. And more than anything, he wanted sobriety. He wanted recovery. He wrote this in his letters to us. He was willing 12 different times to enter treatment in an effort to not die. But in the early morning hours of October 23rd, after saving his friend's life, Jake made the fatal decision to smoke half of a little blue pill marked M30. He was just 24 years old. In Minnesota, just this year, we have seen a 38% increase in overdose deaths. That equates to an estimated 1,188 human lives in Minnesota. And the data from May 2020 to May 2021 indicates the most alarming increase in overdose deaths in any one-year period, with over 100,000 people losing their lives. These are not numbers, however, these are people, humans like my son, humans with mothers and fathers, partners and children that cared for them and loved them. Our family had very few barriers in getting our son the acute treatment care that he needed for his disease, and yet he still died. And I have to wonder today as I listen to Dr. John Kelly and others give testimony that if some of the supports that are proposed in this bill had existed when our son was having his first treatment experiences at the age of 15 and 17 and 20 and 21, perhaps he would be alive today. Quite frankly, my heart broke as I listened to him and recalled the difficulties for my son, not necessarily accessing treatment, but sustaining long-term recovery. Every day I hear stories from families. I work right here in Minnesota, and I hear them expressing the frustrations that exist as it pertains to barriers that prevent their loved ones from accessing treatment when the small window of opportunity presents itself. The frustration of their loved ones getting proper care while they are in treatment and the difficulties in finding those scaffoldings of support, including housing, that are necessary in order to activate and sustain long-term recovery. In our case, our son would be successful for 4 months or 6 months, or even, you know, up to a year. However, at the year mark, usually he started to falter and we faced another reoccurrence of use. One thing I want to mention here is that in our state where opiates are prevalent, one of the most significant barriers for recovery are supports that help people on medications. Aftercare housing presents one of those greatest barriers to long-term recovery. Families want to help their loved ones. Families are the first responders for their loved ones who are suffering, and they look to our community and our legislators and our providers for the help that they need for their loved ones. The bill in front of you highlights some of the difficulties that our providers have experienced in order to ensure proper care for our loved ones, whether it's in the process of our loved ones directly accessing treatment, whether it's caring for those individuals who are providing those services to our families, or the supports that are needed in order for our families to continue their recovery for an extended period of time outside of the structure of residential treatment programs. The testimony of the people you have heard today providing those direct care services to our loved ones matters. We have to do better for the families of Minnesota. These changes that are proposed will save lives. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this includes my portion of the testimony. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Lanhart, for your testimony and our condolences on the loss of your son. Thank you for sharing and letting us know what you'd experienced, what your family's gone through, and to highlight how some of the changes that are being proposed here could make a difference in saving lives as we go forward. So once again, thank you for your willingness to share and condolences on the loss of your son. Any questions or comments for Ms. Lanhart? Seeing none, we will move on to our next testifier then. Our next testifier is Dr. Gavin Bart. Dr. Gavin Bart, if you'd like to introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Gavin Bart, and I am a physician specializing in internal medicine and addiction medicine at Henneman Healthcare, where I direct the Division of Addiction Medicine. Those testifying before me painted a stark picture of the landscape of substance use in Minnesota that I see every day. The use of tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs is the largest preventable cause of death on the planet. This is a problem that affects the C-suites of Minnesota's Fortune 500 companies, the suites of COVID hotels for the insecurely housed, and everywhere in between. While only a minority of those who use these substances have an addiction, this minority disproportionately requires healthcare services, government assistance, and supportive housing, and are too often caught up in the criminal justice system. Lives are lost, dreams and potential unrealized. Fortunately, these substance use disorders are treatable and long-term recovery is possible. Federal statistics show that about 300,000 Minnesotans need but are not receiving life-saving, life-building treatment. For those who do receive treatment, most receive a one-size-fits-all approach, and only about 25% of those with an opioid use disorder receive a highly effective life-saving treatment medication. And so we continue to see a needless and preventable year-over-year increase in overdose deaths. During this meeting, you have heard of the challenges that Minnesotans face when seeking help and the barriers addiction professionals must overcome to offer that help. No one should have to choose between recovery and housing. My patients are frequently denied residential treatment and sober housing because of blanket bans on buprenorphine and methadone, highly effective medications to treat opioid addiction. Criminal justice records further impede safe housing. We must ensure that being locked up because of a mental illness or an addiction isn't being replaced with being locked out of housing because of one's record. How can we expect someone to recover when they don't know where they're going to sleep from night to night? We know that addiction is a disease and that people with addiction deserve access to qualified healthcare professionals. Yet during the Great Resignation, we are seeing many mental health and addiction professionals leave the field and few entering. Root causes include salaries limited by low reimbursement rates, student loan debt, and increased documentation burden. People leaving the field tell me that they feel it is no longer about the patients, but it is now about the paperwork. Important counseling time is replaced by overlapping state and federal requirements to collect redundant information. Worse still, some of the required work is outdated and has the potential to misinform patients. We need greater harmonization of rules to streamline paperwork and place professionals where they want to be with the patients. We need loan repayment programs to bring in and keep people in the field. We need a system that allows people to do the work they have trained for and not be held in limbo between graduation and when the state backlog of licensing is cleared. Finally, we need an adaptive system that is informed by science and understanding that addictions are treatable and recovery is a lifelong process requiring fluctuating levels of support, just as we see with other chronic illnesses like depression, diabetes, and sickle cell disease. This means that people with addiction need ongoing access to care, not just during discrete 28-day or 12-week periods. They need access to support when the wheels begin to wobble and not just after they crash. And they need access to best practices. For example, with methamphetamine now the largest illicit substance use issue in Minnesota, people need access to the most effective treatment to date for methamphetamine use disorder, contingency management, a program based on Nobel Prize-winning economic theory that incentivizes positive behavior and goal achievement. Yet it remains unavailable because we're too slow to transform our care delivery system, billing and coding, and reimbursement systems to meet the evolving evidence. If we are to limit the impact of drugs in Minnesota, we must be nimble, we must be efficient, and we must be ready to meet the patients where and when they need our help. Much as what is being proposed today is cost neutral, and some will require investment. It is my hope this body will adopt these changes so Minnesota can reduce the devastating impact of drugs and alcohol and reap the benefit of a population revitalized by recovery. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Gavin Bart. Is there any questions for Dr. Bart? Seeing no questions, I'll move on next to Ms. Amy Delwu again. And then after that, we have Ms. Tina Silverness and Mr. Brian Zerbes.
Excellent.
Ms. Delwu, if you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And again, Amy Delwu for the record. The content of this bill is a response to the testimony that you heard today. There is a background sheet in your packet if you'd like to follow along with the bill overview. We're going to sketch a few items that perhaps need a little more amplification in terms of what the bill addresses. Article 1, which I'm covering, is dedicated to patient services and supports. This article was constructed after conducting focus groups that involved 400 patients that were currently in treatment, and 90% of them were Medicaid eligible. From these VIPs, we heard about the direct correlation between the recurrence of symptoms or relapse and the lack of support after discharge. The testimony that you heard from Dr. Kelly, Mr. Green, Ms. Lanhart, and Dr. Bart directly relates to some of the solutions that are offered in this article. So I'll start with Section 1. Section 1 relates to housing fidelity bonds. And this is basically getting help access to housing, let alone paying for it. And so just getting in the door. This section actually leverages the existing federal program operated by the Commissioner of Deed. The section directs Deed to seek federal approval to extend their current employer fidelity program in its form and structure to include housing fidelity bonds for Medicaid-eligible people experiencing substance use disorders. And this section also requires the Commissioner of Deed to confer with the Commissioner of Human Services. As you might suspect, rental housing can be a big barrier to people who've had a substance use disorder due to limited rental histories, or for many that have a criminal background that they acquired in the midst of their addiction. Sections 2 through 4 relate to birth certificates and state-issued IDs. Some of the focus group participants spoke of their stretches of homelessness or couch surfing and the difficulty holding on to their stuff. During these times, things like birth certificates and state-issued IDs are easily lost. This section waives the fees of these documents when a person is Medicaid eligible and has received treatment within the year. This language is patterned after the homeless youth language that you passed last year. Section 6 relates to individual counseling access. So once a person has been discharged from treatment, the current administrative barriers make it difficult for that patient to re-engage with a counselor that they spent months getting to know and trust. This section acknowledges substance use disorder as a chronic disease by eliminating those barriers for discharged patients to continue the therapeutic connection with their counselor at their discretion without having to re-enter a full course of treatment. Now, Section 7 is about developing the recovery capital that Dr. Kelly referenced in his presentation. The focus group members reported that they struggled most with housing, transportation, food, and childcare. And what this section asks is that the DHS commissioner to optimize, when possible, existing state and federal funds to create a dependable 6-month package of services that will mitigate these triggers of relapse that often come with the challenges of accessing community supports after treatment completion. By providing a 6 months of recovery capital, it's the start to for people to gain a solid foothold in remission and the sober community. Flexible transportation and childcare is key to helping people to continue to work a recovery focused program by getting to AA and NA, which is not covered by non-emergency medical transportation, or getting to a job or volunteer work. Certainly, a housing voucher and food are essential for community living. In fact, a woman in the focus groups had mentioned that after treatment, the only sure place she knows that she can sleep is at a home that has active drug use occurring. Now, Section 5 and 8 relate to guest speaker options. These sections give the counselor more opportunity to bring in a guest speaker to group therapy who's an expert in their subject matter. Currently, unless the guest speaker is an LADC or licensed alcohol and drug counselor, the time spent in group is not reimbursed by the state. To illustrate this, not all counselors are actually in recovery. So if a counselor showed a TED talk of someone talking about their recovery journey, that would be a permissible reimbursed group hour. But if the counselor invited actually TED to the group for the identical presentation, and TED isn't an LADC licensed person, the group hour isn't covered. So these sections ensure that there can be more diversity in the group therapy sessions and the scope of topics that the guest speakers cover are therapeutically related. And finally, in this article is reporting and access data. Substance use disorder treatment providers currently provide a lot of data to DHS. However, this data is not made available back to providers to help them improve their work with patients. While the healthcare system is moving on in terms of evidence-based and data-driven decision-making, substance use disorder treatment providers in Minnesota are still trying to get basic data reports from DHS. This section requests providers get usable data in an electronic format at least annually. So, Mr. Chair, for those who are the VIPs who participated in focus groups, I want to thank them for their authentic engagement and insight, and I hope that they feel heard and that we've honored them, their voices, with the language that we've put forward before you today. And I believe that they are laying down the paving stones of progress for those who will come behind them. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Tina Silverness. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dillwell. Before we move on, I just want to double check to see if there's any questions on the first section, first article that was presented here. Not seeing any questions, so we'll move on to Ms. Tina Silverness. If you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, then start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. My name is Tina Silverness, and I am the CEO for the Center for Alcohol and Drug Treatment in Duluth. I'm also on March's board, and co-chair for the Government Affairs Committee. The first section of Article 2 addresses the continuity of work between former interns and the Alcohol and Drug Counselor's licensure approval. The issue has been that emerging clinicians can wait several weeks for BBHT to approve their LEDC license due to the required paperwork from their schools and the second background check. These delays impact workforce and continuity care for our clients. They are not allowed to practice during this time period, despite having met all the competency requirements. This proposal would allow former LADC students a 90-day window to practice from the date of the student's degree conferral and under the supervision of the agency. The second proposal, which is now moved to Article 3, is simply to ask the commissioner to outline HIV topic sections for staff training so that providers can develop their own accurate training without having to use an outdated 31-page document. The next section addresses flexibility in residential treatment hours and co-occurring credentialed staff. Residential programs generally provide more than the required hours for weekly billable services to patients just to meet the current requirements. The issue is that some patients have difficulty participating in all the weekly programming. These patients have much needed medical and dental appointments. Some clients have COVID-19. There's motivational and psychological issues. There's just a wide array of very legitimate reasons why they may not be participating. Program staff end up dedicating more time addressing these issues compared to their stable, engaged patients. Yet providers are being asked to bill for fewer services and are then being threatened with allegations of fraud and clawback if they do bill for the patient's level of intensity. Additionally, providers with a co-occurring enhanced license are required to have 25% of their clinical team be fully licensed professionals, and there's a limit on the number of interns and pre-licensed staff the agency can engage. This not only creates an undue burden due to the workforce shortage, but these ratios punish learning institutions for providing internship opportunities and those agencies who are developing mental health practitioners. So this proposal provides a means for programs to get reimbursed when the patient is unable to attend all the weekly programming hours and would allow for providers to determine the adequate staffing complement for co-occurring programs as long as they meet the basic requirements. Next, in the 2021 session, the Commissioner of Human Services was directed to conduct a substance use disorder rate methodology. The SUD base rates have essentially held flat for the last 12 years. So this rate methodology is overdue. Beginning July of 2024, this proposal would provide a temporary rate increase of 14% if the new rate setting process has not been implemented. Once the rate methodology is implemented, this temporary increase would expire. The intention of this proposal is to ensure that providers are not held in limbo indefinitely for the rate adjustments due to DHS delays. The final section in Article 2 is the substance use disorder direct care increase. The ability to pay competitive wages to direct care staff is increasingly difficult. Treatment providers are competing against other less intensive industries that will pay better wages and benefits. This proposal would allow a 10% base rate increase for direct care staff. Essentially, we are asking that if the legislature implements workforce solutions with rate increases for the care industries, the substance use providers would like to be included. This concludes my testimony, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Silverness. I will hold a second to see if there are any questions for you. Not seeing any hands go up. We will next move on to Mr. Brian Zervis. Mr. Zervis, if you'd like to introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Excuse me. My name is Brian Zervis. I'm the Vice President of Policy, Compliance, and Government Relations for North Star Behavioral Health, a substance disorder organization in Minnesota providing services in the metro area, St. Cloud, and Fergus Falls. I also serve as the co-chair of March's Government Affairs Committee with Ms. Silverness, who just testified. I'm going to be providing an overview of Article 3, which is Service Preservation Access. This article aims to address administrative barriers for access, address, and clarify documentation standards in the substance disorder field. First, to improve access under Section 1 is addressing withdrawal management programs. Per previous testimony, there's an overwhelming prevalence of overdose deaths, and there are challenges with starting treatment for people while they're intoxicated or in withdrawal. Currently, withdrawal management programs can only operate with what's called a supervised living facility Class B license, which is for non-ambulatory patients. Many residential substance disorder programs already meet the supervised living facility Class A license, which is for ambulatory patients. The physical plant requirements for Class B include more required space for bedrooms, hallways, and common areas. These additional requirements prevent existing substance use disorder providers from opening withdrawal management programs due to cost prohibitions of renovating that space to meet these requirements. The next sections are on documentation standards. As Anderson St. George and Sadie have already noted in their testimony, these changes will provide relief to administrative burden for counselors, which will allow them more time to interact with clients. The Section 3, the documentation requirements for significant events will clarify the documentation requirements that when there's a significant event, instead of documenting immediately, it will allow up to 24 hours for the counselor to document those significant events, which is important for counselors to be able to maintain safe and therapeutic environment. When there's issues happening in a program, that they can then document within 24 hours those issues that happen. In Section 4 is extending the treatment plan requirements. A couple important points to note: March conducted surveys of counselors, and as previous testifiers already noted, the frequency of weekly treatment plan requirements is a challenge. In a March survey of our counselors, our clinical staff that provide treatment planning, on average, they're spending about 4.5 hours per week on treatment planning. About half of the time that the counselors are doing treatment plans, there are half the time there are not updates needed in that treatment plan. So it's important to note that it's important in that these treatment plans will be updated as needed within that 28-day window, but currently the frequency is burdensome. The next section in Section 5 is requesting to add a substance disorder rates to the annual report. The commissioner currently publishes an annual report on reimbursement rates that managed care and county-based purchasing plans pay for dental, physician, hospital, and mental health services. This section is requesting to add substance disorder services to this report. Having this data on reimbursement rates paid will help inform policymakers on SCD reimbursement for services. The last section in Section 6 is requesting an extension for the paperwork reduction report. The 2021 legislative session provided direction for a paperwork reduction report to be completed by December 2022. Consulting with a contractor and experience in paperwork reduction in multiple states will be invaluable. The funding for the study was tied to HCBS FMAP funding, which required review from CMS. The final approval was recently received this past January, which will allow the request for proposal and vendor selection to commence. This section is seeking to have the report due within 2 years of contracting with that qualified vendor. This will allow time for meaningful engagement and evaluation of this important work. Mr. Chair and committee members, March appreciates the time and attention to this committee has devoted to the prevention, treatment, and recovery efforts for all in Minnesota. I want to acknowledge and thank the previous testifiers on these proposals. Policymakers, payers, and providers need to work together to make meaningful and long-lasting changes. We're very proud to report that this proposal has significant involvement and input from not only providers, but also from the people we serve. We look forward to the continued engagement and support to improve the quality and effectiveness of substance disorder services in Minnesota. This concludes our testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zerbis, for your presentation and testimony, and thank you to all the testifiers that we've had before us today. It's been a very educational process and helps give us all a better understanding of what the challenges are out in the world and some great proposals to try to address it. We do have time for questions, so if you have any questions, please raise your hand. And I see Representative Baker, if you'd like to go ahead, sir.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I just wanted to kind of hold my comments at the end because there has been a lot of amazing testimony today. And you know, I think that we have a huge responsibility here as a committee to really make sure this thing gets pushed forward. This is sort of like, I think, the moment when March took a ton of time to really dive into what is causing these relapses. And if we're used to seeing, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 relapses or re-entries into treatment, and how do we get over this thing? We are not going to do this any better than just trying to eliminate a few of those steps. If we can go from 8 to 5, that is a huge win to all of us. It's a huge win. You know, seeing what Dr. Bart has done over the years and seeing what Amy has done and all the folks that are on this call, I just know that their hearts are in the right place. So I feel like the March work that has been done here has been sort of like the Minnesota Miracle 4.0. We have to relook at this in a way now that we need to, as a whole bipartisan support network here, to move forward on this thing. There's some things missing. There's some things I think we need to keep tweaking. But I'll tell you, when I drove into this and Representative Frankie and I were able to meet with some of the folks and we kind of were able to really dive into some of these details, this is really overall really, really good and strong. And we need to make sure that this year when we can really focus on a lot of policy stuff that makes sense. They're so right. When somebody gets out of treatment or incarceration, we've got to find a way to give them some housing support that is specific to them, not everybody, but to them in recovery. There's so much, you know, paperwork reduction makes sense here in a way that they've laid it out. It's not walking away from any responsibility, but it's doing it in the right way. You know, hearing Anderson St. George's was really, again, important to hear. That's what they really need to spend more time in the field that they want to do is to be with people. And again, why isn't DHS giving us the reports back that has been demanded upon? Well, we should get something back. And DHS has been notorious. My friends at DHS have been notorious about pushing the kettle down the road and making sure that the reimbursements are coming. But look at what happened in the long delays of 1115 waivers. I mean, just imagine this kind of thing. So their requests here today, folks, are very reasonable. And I hope that we as a committee, Mr. Chair, thank you for giving us all this time on this. And again, just to everybody that's on this, Representative Fredericks, for carrying the load on this thing. This is a really good bill. I'm looking forward to seeing the actual number to it. Great work, everybody. I am feeling like with my involvement with the ORAC group and our work on the licensing reforms and the lawsuits that are coming, we are starting to build this new foundation in Minnesota with a bill like this. So I feel there's a lot of hope today, and I just want to say thanks for bringing this forward, for doing all this detailed work, and let's all together figure out a way to get this done. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to make those comments, and again, for bringing the bill forward. Representative Frederick.
You're welcome, Representative Baker, and thank you for the work that you've been helping provide on this as this is going through the process. I know that you and Representative Frankie have been involved in it, along with Representative Frederick. You're absolutely right. This is something that is going to be a strong bipartisan effort. This is something that we want to make sure we get the bill put together properly so we can get through the process. They've raised a lot of great points and a lot of great opportunities to improve our successes. Representative Katisa Watum, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on how much how much joy it brings me to see childcare included in these supports, because as we know, the childcare industry and families who are already struggling even before potential substance abuse challenges, it's really difficult to find childcare. And so I think, you know, when we speak about things like the opioid epidemic and we see so many more children in out-of-home placements in foster care, they're connected, right? I mean, so if parents are struggling with substance abuse disorders and they can't get the support and the help that they need to really make it through and kind of come really get back to their family without childcare supports, without housing supports, it just makes it all the more difficult. So I think that this is really going to do a lot to keep some of these families together, to bring some of these families back together. And I just want to say thank you to all involved.
Thank you, Representative Catizo Watun. Representative Frankie, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. First, I want to start off by thanking Representative Fredericks for bringing me in on this early and just allowing me to bring some experience to this conversation. You know, I just can't thank March enough for the work that they've done on this throughout the years and my time serving. A lot of times, you know, everything we go through, you start to doubt, why do I do this? Well, for me personally, and a lot of passion that I have, this bill right here, this reminds me why I do this. I can't thank March enough for their willingness to have discussions, to take the time to explain to us, to have the ability to adapt to our concerns. I do have questions and concerns about certain areas and small things, but we'll get to those. You know, we'll work through those. But I don't know, and I'm sure it's just me on this call today, but going through this bill and some of this discussion about these gaps, the transition points, the ability to have, you know, stable housing, the transportation, you know, access to food, childcare, whatever it may be. Transportation. I mean, when we're talking about transportation, I forget whether it was Amy or Brian was talking about, you know, just having the ability to, you know, get to an NA meeting or an AA meeting. I remember riding my bike 5 miles to an NA meeting 3 times a week because I didn't have a driver's license, because I had lost my ability to drive through poor decision making due to my addiction issues. So I get that. So I'm more than happy to bring my experience and passion to this discussion and be able to work through these, because I think that just like some of the work we did last year is a game changer for the system, I think a lot of what's in this bill can be a game changer for the people that are living on the addiction side of it. We can provide more help and stability to work towards long-term recovery. It's just not getting people into treatment anymore. That's not my goal. Just not making sure people are set aside. I want to do work that allows us to have people enjoy long-term recovery. So I'm just going to end by saying thank you. Thank you to everybody, and look forward to working on this going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fredericks.
You're welcome, Representative Frankie, and thank you for the words, and thank you also for the interest and working together with everybody to help make sure we're addressing this as we move forward. Representative Frederick. You're on mute, sir.
I'll figure this out eventually. It's pretty easy for me to dive into the weeds on this stuff. And so at the beginning of this, I caught myself kind of just diving into some of that, talking about housing and these other pieces, because I get excited by that stuff. I want to shout out to Ms. Lanhart, who shared her story, and it was right here. But I think it put a pretty big emphasis on that point specifically. But all of this is so interconnected. And I want to again say a big thank you to Ms. Delwu and the amount of work that she has put into this meeting with everybody and helping get everything organized. We wouldn't be having this conversation today if it wasn't for her. So thank you to her and all of the other testifiers and everyone else that's been blowing up my phone saying that they want to sign on in support of that, which is super cool. And so I'm pretty excited to see this moving forward, and I'm excited for future conversations too. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. And I don't see any other hands out there. And I once again want to say thank you to everyone who's been involved with the presentations and for the work that you folks have been doing, not only this year, but in the preceding years. It's one of the things that has helped me have a better understanding that this is a chronic disease and we need to be addressing it from a long-term proposal where not just when they come in, but also as they're leaving the current treatment facility to make sure that we're setting them up for success. I very much appreciate that the March organization and the people involved are looking at trying to meet their clients where they're at. And, you know, when I've worked in the homeless youth world, that's one of the critical things that we do is we center our stuff is where are you trying to meet them where they're at. And I feel that the proposal that's coming out here is really taking that client-centered approach. And I want to say thank you for that focus and for the work that's being done on it. It's something I know that Representative Frederick, Representative Frankie, Representative Baker, and the rest of us will continue to follow to make sure that we can continue to move this forward to get some transformational changes happening that will increase the successes as we're going forward out there. I'm not seeing any other hands, so we're getting close to wrapping up here. We're going to be slightly ahead of time. What I want to also remind people as going forward, we will be having our next meeting next week. We will have a couple of bills. And also, we are going to be losing Chris McCall here. Chris McCall is taking a new position over here in the House, and we will be having a new committee administrator taking over for the division. That will be Lindsay Hansen will be taking over as committee administrator. So the next meeting notices that you have will be coming out from her. And as you have things that need to go back and forth, Lindsay will be the one that will be coordinating everything. And I'm sure if we have questions going forward that on occasion, I may be able to lean on Chris for a little assistance here and there. So I want to say, first of all, thank you, Chris, for all the work and support that you've done. I have found it to be very amazing and has led us to be very successful last year. You know, when you take a look that every bill passed out 100% last year and that most of those bills became law, it's because of not only the work of us, but more importantly, the work of the staff that we have behind the scenes, making sure that we can get it done and helping us remind us where we were, what happened, and coordinate all that stuff. So, Chris, I'd like to say thank you so much and wish you best in your new role and look forward to continue to work with you as we go forward. And we'll be looking forward to seeing Ms. Hansen next week. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.